In the Moment is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 26th to 28th in Spearfish.
Public Radio is here to help us understand how state government works. Let's get started. From SDPB, today is Wednesday, July 22nd. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, former state legislators Gene Hunhoff and Linda Duba are with us. We'll discuss the latest stop on the path to a new men's prison. South Dakota Attorney General Marty Jackley is also with us. He says for law enforcement officers, the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally begins on Saturday. We'll talk about plans for public safety. We'll also discuss the partnership with federal immigration officials and how he intends to use 827G authority in the days ahead. Plus, Aberdeen businessman Toby Doden joins us for a look at his campaign for governor. That's coming a bit later in the hour. We are broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm your host, Lori Walsh. South Dakota Attorney General Marty Jackley stopped by the SDPB studios this week. I spoke with him for an update on the 287G immigration partnership with the federal government. We also discussed law enforcement preparations for the annual Sturgis Motorcycle Rally and how federal cuts to public broadcasting could impact public safety in South Dakota. We have an update on the 287G program. You and I have talked about that before. That was before there was training, and the partnership with DCI was not quite as solidified as it is now. Help me understand what's happening now with the program.
So Homeland Security has approved my request to be able to have a federal component in DCI that has the capability, and I've limited to violent criminals and drug dealers, so that we can be involved in an arrest to make a decision whether that individual should go through the criminal process here in South Dakota or whether or not we should utilize the deportation process. And it gives us a capability to do steps in that process.
What's that training like?
So that training, and what I like about it is the Trump administration is allowing us to do it by Zoom. It's 40 hours of training, and they're going to teach a couple of our agents the process, how to go through due process. If we have an individual that has committed that violent crime, is a drug dealer, to be able to go through the deportation process rather than put a victim through 18 months of a criminal process, putting investigators and limited resources through that and prosecutors. So this is a good opportunity for South Dakota. It's limited to violent criminals and drug dealers that are not legally here. It will have a due process component. That's very important to me as Attorney General. But it really gives us an ability to better protect South Dakota. And even though it's two DCI agents right now, I want to make that resource available to our sheriffs and chiefs. So if they come across that situation, we want to have the training and be able to assist them through that process.
Have you used that authority yet?
I've not used that authority yet. Technically, until we've gone through the 40 hours of training, we've not been able to use it. I like to use the example of the Romanian case that we had a few years back, where if I would have had that capability, we would have looked to do that rather than a criminal process where we put a second-degree rape victim through 18 months of process. Our investigators and our prosecutors, those resources could have been better utilized to better ensure safety here in South Dakota.
All right. Another thing that we're looking at right now is the run-up to the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally. Give us an idea of behind the scenes how you're preparing with law enforcement officers across the state.
To start with, having grown up in Sturgis, I realize the benefit South Dakota and the Black Hills communities receive from the rally. A lot of people come out to South Dakota. They enjoy the beauty our state has to offer, and that does create some additional challenges for law enforcement when you bring in, whether it's 500,000 people, 750,000 people. For me, that process starts this Saturday. I'm blessed to be involved with the Buffalo Chips putting up 800 flags. It's veteran-oriented, but it kicks off Saturday. And then law enforcement's going back to the traditional, the Sunday of the rally. We will all gather, that state, federal, local law enforcement. We have a little get-together where we just get to know each other, and that helps because during the week there'll be times we need to rely heavily upon each other, and I just think getting us together, having good conversation, looking at the different operations that we're doing is important. We will always have some type of operation to protect kids. There'll be a component with the ICAC, Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, where we're out there actively being proactive to pull those individuals off the streets that may be looking to harm our kids.
All right. You have an origin story of growing up in Sturgis that ties into law enforcement in some way?
Well, I do. My dad was the state's attorney. It's not the easiest thing when you grow up in a community where your dad is the state's attorney. But that taught me well. And frankly, being able to see the things that he did have I think, brought an interest to me in law enforcement. And I think a perspective during the rally that there are thousands of people there that are law-abiding. And our job is to find the handful that aren't and get them off the streets so that we can have an enjoyable rally for the business community and those that are out in the hills to enjoy the beautiful Black Hills in South Dakota.
Cuts to South Dakota Public Broadcasting, how they might impact public safety. What do you have your eyes on in South Dakota?
Well, certainly last legislative session, as you know, there were questions raised, and I've always taken the position as Attorney General that we rely on public broadcasting. There are functions in the public, whether it be an Amber Alert and other things where public broadcasting reaches an area in South Dakota. We utilize that, and I consider that a component of public safety.
So are you concerned?
Certainly, I and law enforcement rely upon public safety for certain functions to get the word out, and we like having that available. I recognize that there's a state component to that, there's a federal component to that, and there's a charitable component to that. And my hope as Attorney General is that public broadcasting is able to continue and provide that service that law enforcement needs and appreciates.
Would there be a financial impact on your department if you had to take on some of those roles?
I don't know that the Attorney General has necessarily the capability to be directly involved in the broadcasting aspect, but certainly when it comes to Amber Alerts, missing person alerts, the other things that we rely upon public broadcasting on, I feel we need to have that, and I'm hoping that from the state funding side, the federal funding side, and the charitable funding side, that public broadcasting can continue to operate and provide that very valuable service to South Dakota.
Anything else you've got going today? There seems to be a press release every other day about activities from new laws that have been passed to a Supreme Court decision.
It's been a good week. I had an opportunity on my way to Sioux Falls to go to Lower Brule and meet with the tribal council and had a good conversation about law enforcement partnerships, partnerships that go to the training of the tribal officers, some of the BI officers, the desire to continue to work with federal authorities, the U.S. attorney to get that training here in South Dakota. Last summer, we were blessed that the U.S. Attorney's Office was very supportive of that training. They provided resources so that we could train tribal officers, then also have them obtain that federal component, which takes about 2 days versus 2 to 3 weeks in New Mexico. That makes sense for our law enforcement officers. And I've always believed that in South Dakota, we provide the best training in the nation, and I want to see the capability of doing more and more of that, not just necessarily with tribal, state, but to continue to have federal authorities provide resources for that. It provides stronger training and consistency in that training, which is a good thing.
That's South Dakota Attorney General Marty Jackley. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The future of a men's state prison in South Dakota is coming into focus. A task force is recommending a new 1,500-bed facility on the north side of Sioux Falls with a price cap of $650 million. Governor Larry Brodin has called a special legislative session for September 25th. The goal is passing legislation that gives the Department of Corrections a path forward to building the new prison. Also, the State Appropriations Committee meets today. On the original agenda, but later struck, a conversation about, quote, zero-based budgeting. SDPB is here to help you understand how your government works, even when the mechanics are complex. For today's Dakota Political Junkies conversation, we welcome Jean Hunhoff and Linda Duba. Former Senator Hunhoff is the longest-serving female member of the South Dakota legislature at 24 years. Linda Duba is a former state representative. Both women served on the Joint Appropriations Committee.
When you're in appropriations, you have to have a wider lens. Yeah. People say there's a party lens, but you have to really look at something from impact. You know, impact and outcome. And if you're trying to understand impact and outcome, the importance is to use the data that's been presented to you to get the biggest bang for your buck. It may be part of a party's ideology, but essentially what it's saying is this is what's best for the state, for the people of South Dakota.
Senator Inhofe, that's where you get to where you often say, I need the data. I need the information.
Absolutely. And I think appropriations, yes, it is a process, but it's also a compromise process. Mm-hmm. And it's to get to that compromise as to what that vision is or what the priorities are. And that's where the debate becomes then and sort of becomes party line as to what we should be doing with the taxpayer dollars to prioritize. I can only speak from when we were in the legislature, and that was part of it. The two parties would establish their priorities. They'd come together, and we'd have some early on discussions to know, okay, what are the things we're on the same page for so we don't have to spend time on that? Where are the differences, and how do we bring those differences closer together that we are meeting those needs? And I think that's the piece that I always looked at, and to me it was the data that drives that, so that as Linda said, you've got to have a bigger vision out there, and you've got to look at what are we trying to achieve, and then what do we have to show that we achieved it or did not achieve it? Mm-hmm. Because, again, if we're using taxpayer dollars, there needs to be a definite outcome for those dollars, and we need to see the results.
Let's talk about the Project Prison Reset. We have a date for a special session. We have a new plan. What are some of the things that you're noticing about the new plan? Representative Duba, you want to start there?
I listened to or attended each one of those meetings, mostly listened to, and then I showed up on the last day. What I found interesting, and I've said this in the past, is we've had two major studies now conducted. Both of them came back with the same results. We need to build a 1,500-person facility. It needs to be close to Sioux Falls. It needs to have all of these functions, and we need to have education and retraining and rehabilitation. Let's do this the right way. And then in comes a group, and we worked very hard for 3 years. And I will credit Jean Hunhoff sitting next to me, who established that prison task force fund, that trust fund. We put our monies in there so that we could save. We've saved significant amount of funding, and yet the task force comes back, puts a cap on it, and says, no more than this. And all the studies point to it's probably going to cost us this much. Now, the other thing that frustrated me is that we are going to lose about $40 million out of the money that we invested in the Lincoln County site. So I want all of South Dakota to understand that that money is now throwaway, not to mention the amount of money that we're paying out for this task force to take place, for all the work we've had to do to support it, the additional studies, and the amount of time that we are going to lose as a result of waiting, waiting, waiting. In the end, the group passed a bill that said we're going to spend $650, even though the experts said it's going to cost $725.
Passed a recommendation. Sent that recommendation up to the governor, yeah.
So data is what should drive our decisions, not emotion, but real data. We presented real data. We did all of the things that we needed to do. And I'm concerned. And also, the other thing that people don't understand is we do not have to write a check for $650 million on the very first day that we put a shovel in the ground. So we can fund this. But understand that by putting this cap on there, we may have to do some reductions in areas that we choose not to.
Jean Hunhoff, what would you add to that? And are you concerned?
Well, I'm concerned that we get a product at the end of the day. We need a prison. That's what we need. And unfortunately, in the dialogue, all these other byproducts kept coming in there and playing in. And so the focus, not till the very end, and then this decision as to what the bed size would be, and that was the original. I guess a couple things come in mind. First of all, I did not attend, and I listened to some, but I didn't. But at the end of the day, apparently this last location that is being identified as a potential really is, if the consultants came back in, they would indicate this is the number one choice. Mm-hmm. And part of that is because the utilities are already in the ground, and that saves us about $18 million.
That's true.
So we've got that point. It's only a mile away from the standing. Again, I was trying to get some location on that. And I think the other point is that, you know, along this process, And everybody chipped in to that bill that we established the prison construction fund. That was visionary to say, we don't want to take it out of general. We want to pay up front. We want to make sure we're able to do that. And we were able to get, I believe there's a little over under $600 million in that fund now. Mm-hmm. And this year, then Representative Van Huysen introduced a bill that said all the interest on those dollars would go to that fund so that they wouldn't go back to the general fund. And I believe on July 1st, I heard there was about $24 million that went into that. Okay. So let's say $624 and plus there's some out there. The other thing is we also heard that at the end of the year that our reserves have exceeded more than our expectations. You know, it has been a past in the history that when you looked at the reserves, that the governor would say 10% of your budget should be reserves. And I believe we're closer now to about 20%. So there are additional dollars. And I think the other thing is, if you remember during session, there was just two camps in the legislature, and one was on the prison fund, leftover dollars to supplement, to put more in there that was left. But at the same time, this was coming from the unclaimed property. And there was another camp out there that said, no, we can't. We've got to put that money in a separate that only goes to support if those people come back to claim their dollars. It never got resolved at the session. So those dollars then that were left over flowed into the general, which then falls to the bottom line, which then goes to the reserve funds, which are the 20%. Mm-hmm. So if you took all that into place, there are dollars. Now, again, the conversation is in the kind of design. The beds are there, the 1,500. That's what was decided upon. The question would be, are they telling us then the same spaces that we were looking for all the additional programming and the other sidebar that went on? What are we doing to work with our felons when they get out, rehab, and all that. Mm-hmm. So is there enough there for all of that so that we can develop some really better programs than we're providing, but you need adequate education and space in that facility? So that's the question that's out there. Can that still be achieved with this same number, with a reduced number for the project, the whole project? I don't know that answer.
Yeah. I have a couple things I want to dive into here. One is with the recidivism and juvenile justice, because you were both here when the juvenile justice, the way we do juvenile justice in South Dakota changed drastically. And some of the arguments in other states is that the pipeline, when you put fewer young people in incarceration, that we're not going to need as many beds in a prison because we have taken reasonable steps to keep the age of entry reduced. I don't know if that's true or not. That's just some of the arguments. Mm-hmm. And then we look at the sentencing in South Dakota, which has also been brought up as a challenge, saying like, hey, if you want to have truth in sentencing, which is what it was called, and make sure that people get a full sentence, give judges a little less leeway to make those decisions, all this kind of goes into a big soup of what we're predicting the future. 1,500 beds is still, though, a good number. Why?
Senator Hudhoff said it best. If we do not have the space and the dollars to dedicate to the individuals who will support this programming, 1,500 beds isn't going to be enough. Mm. We know one of the concerns that we had is there was this talk about, well, let's do it at 1,200. We knew then in 3 years or 4 years when this opened, we'd already be overcapacitized. So 15 is the number, and if we don't change some of the ways that we deal with sentencing and programming and dedicate dollars to that, whether it be in juvenile situations or with these prison programs, 1,500 isn't going to be enough. And that second study told us that. Mm. So if we do nothing other than build a facility and not really focus on programming and probation and parole, and continue to focus our efforts on juvenile justice and rehabilitation there, 1,500 isn't going to be enough.
You hit on a key about the 1,500 and the number in the sense that you're just talking about programming. You know, during the dialogue, programming came into there and what we need for rehab. Let's go back 4 or 5 years when the secretary came. She changed behavioral health It was under the auspices of the Department of Social Services. They contracted with corrections to provide the behavioral health and the facilities or the recovery. Well, when she came, she decided that in her experience, it worked better if they would take those people themselves, that they would be the owners, the employers, rather than contract with DSS, they would now become employees of corrections, and then they'd have more direct role and contact.
You mean Secretary Wasco?
Yes. Okay. Yes, when she came. So that change was made. And that was a disruption. There's no doubt about that. Yeah. The people were, you know, that was a change. They were uncomfortable about that, but I don't know how that has worked out. My concern is, and this is a personal experience, so this summer we've been using day parolees in and paying them for work, for day work. Doing for us. Sometimes it means that I have to transport them from Yankton to where they're going to go to work and bring them back and do all that. I've had a very unique experience in visiting with about six of these individuals that I've had encountered this summer, and to really realize what they're going through and the challenges that inside and when they come out. When they come out, they're absolutely, they're on parole, but they're on their own. I mean, I've had to drop someone off before I took him back to his home at the pharmacy so he could pick up his medication. They need time off to get clothes from a clothing closet or whatever. My point is this. It's not just in the prison that we're talking about. I think what they're talking about there is mental health, substance abuse problems, and that. It's when they get out. Mm-hmm. It's going to take more resources out there. These people need transitioning. They need assistance. They need everything. They've been in prison, and now all of a sudden they're walk to the door and say, good luck, goodbye, meet with your parole officer, and life is supposed to go on. So I think there's a bigger picture out there, and that with the 1,500 beds, how does that relate to it? If we're not addressing that and able to meet that, and you still send them out the same way and they don't get that, you're just going to have recidivism come right back, and there's no discussion. The only thing I have heard is that I believe there's been a comment made that the secretary said she's going to have to come back this year to appropriations about money for staffing if we're going to beef these up. And I certainly, there's a way to do that, and we need to do that. But there's a big picture here that I think, again, this prison is just a foundation. It is not the answer to everything. And we've got to make sure we've got a great foundation that we can take care of the people and start a good system there. But it's got to be extended out into the community.
I agree. 110%. We want to integrate these people back into society, and they want to be. But if we aren't going to provide the resources, and when I say that, that means people and programming, which costs money, which then again would come through the state of South Dakota. If we aren't going to dedicate funding to that, then 1,500 beds is not going to be close. And there is a task force this summer that's supposedly addressing this. It takes more than four meetings to address this. We need this ongoing. This should be an ongoing focus. Not necessarily, I guess you could call it the legislature, but it should be a focus of the state of South Dakota to figure out how this works. We're more than a building.
The juvenile justice changes that happened with that reform, do we have a sense of outcomes of
those?
Yes,
we do. Now, again, I was on that committee for 5 years, and my last meeting, I think, was in October, November of 2024. But one of the key things that we were looking at over time was programming. Okay, how do we keep these kids out of JDC, out of prison, and what kinds of supports and services are we going to provide for them and their families to move them along the right track? Mm-hmm. You're going to remember this. We had a bill that came to the Appropriations Committee that we passed and the legislature passed. We upped the amount of reimbursement for counties to provide programming, and what we saw was an increase in the number of kids that were serviced, as well as the number of programs that now came online because we changed the reimbursement rates for the counties. That made a huge difference to those families. And so we're tracking, we call it recidivism as well, we're tracking whether those kids come back through the system or not.
Senator Hunhoff.
Representative Dubois was more involved with that. I didn't sit on any of those horses, so I just came back. But again, it's like anything else. If you want to be proactive, you've got to start with prevention, and you've got to get that early on. So it's really key in those juvenile diversion programs that we're providing or that we're doing for, that you get those kids then so they don't end up in the pen. But again, it takes resources. And that is always the dilemma over the 5 to 10 years is, do we allocate resources to that? Oh, we can't, you know, there was reluctance. You know, the people were not comfortable in doing that. They knew we needed to do it, but they didn't know how to do it. And that's the other thing. You've got the agencies. They're the experts in the field. They're working. I mean, there's now a reluctance to listen to agencies that, you know, they're not doing their job. Well, I believe they are doing their job. They're trying to work within the parameters we set with them as to what how we fund them. But, you know, I am a lot into prevention and trying to nip this in the bud early on so we're not at the point we're at. And we're not doing that. We're real slow at doing that.
What is zero-based budgeting?
Zero-based budgeting means that you budget for every expense you think you're going to have, actual expense. So I'll use the example. So all your paper, pencil supplies, you're going to have to exact numbers of how many you're going to need. In your programming, how many people enrolled are you going to have in there? How many people do you think are going to leave state government and retire, and how are you going to cover those costs? So that if in a program there's only, you budget for supplies, and I'll just be simplistic, I'll say you budget $30,000 for supplies, all right? And if you have more people in the program and you have more supplies and you don't have $30,000, you have actually $40,000 of expenses, you're short $10,000. Well, if I'm short, then I'm going to have to look at the other departments around there, the other programs within that department. And is anybody long? Did they not have as many eligibles, or can I transfer those dollars so I can fill this bucket? So now it will be, if a department becomes short, there isn't a replacement unless another program is not seeing the same level. And you really don't know that till the end of the year. But you're budgeting for what you believe is your actual cost to run your program.
That's former State Senator Jean Hunhoff and former State Representative Linda Duba. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, we are more than a year out from the gubernatorial election, but our next guest has hit the campaign trail early. Toby Doden launched his campaign on May 28th, and he has spent tens of thousands of dollars for television ads already, largely highlighting his support of the president. Toby Doden stopped by the SDPB studios in Sioux Falls to discuss his campaign. You have been all over the state. Tell me a little bit about the energy that you're finding from people who come up and want to shake your hand in the line.
Listen, when I got involved in this whole process a couple of years ago, I was probably the least political person you had ever met. And so when I was trying to get a pulse for the people in South Dakota a couple of years ago when I started my political action committee, I traveled the state then too for several months talking to thousands of people. And so it's very reinvigorating to go see people's passion, but it's also frustrating because a lot of people are struggling financially right now, especially in light of what's happened the last 4 or 5 years. There's people that are frustrated, and there's some people that are just downright angry. So it is very rewarding. It's been very reinvigorating for me to go see all of the people in the state. West River has some unique issues from East River, and so that's been a great experience. But overall, it's been amazing. The energy is high, and people are very, very excited about somebody outside of politics getting this involved.
What are some of the residual effects of the pandemic? You mentioned the last 4 or 5 years. We're 5 years on from a pandemic which traversed the Trump administration, the first Trump administration, the Biden administration, and another Trump administration. A lot has happened, a lot of inflationary pressures. What are you seeing some of the things that are left over? Where have we moved on, and where have we learned lessons, and where maybe we're still dealing with some of the impacts?
Yeah, there's a lot of issues, and what I've learned in my life and my career is that all issues are impacted more negatively when there's financial ramifications as well. And so when you talk about what happened during COVID, you talk about what happened specifically during the Biden-Harris administration, we had, you know, massive super inflation. You know, property taxes have doubled almost everywhere in this state the last 4.5 years. You know, utilities have doubled in most cases, homeowners insurance, car insurance, groceries, gas, everything's higher. And unfortunately, wages are virtually flat for most, you know, folks in this state. Small business revenue is virtually flat for most small businesses in this state. So we have folks taking in the same amount of income they did 3, 4, and 5 years ago, yet the cost to run their family has gone up significantly, and it's having a massive, massive impact on most South Dakota families, and it's very sad.
What's your plan?
I have a very, very bold plan for the future of South Dakota, and that bold plan is to keep South Dakota the greatest state in our country. And my opponent in this race has a much different vision of the future of South Dakota. My vision is that we continue to build this economy on the backs of hardworking business owners, farmers, ranchers. Those are the folks that built this state. Ever since South Dakota became a state, the foundation of our economy has been small business owners. Sadly, we've had more than 12,000 small businesses close in this state since 2020. It's very, very, very sad. And so I said at my kickoff on May 28th that we were going to set up a small business task force when the DOD administration takes office. I'm going to serve on that task force as governor. I'm going to bring in the smartest and brightest small business minds in the state, and we are going to work on ways. We are going to brainstorm and find new ways to help our small businesses, our existing small businesses. There's 75,000 of them, and they're struggling right now. And while small businesses are struggling because nobody's paying attention to them, my opponent in this race and a lot of the people supporting him are in favor of big corporate government, big corporate welfare. They want to take our tax dollars and they want to subsidize and incentivize multi-billion dollar companies to set up shop in South Dakota. I'm talking about data centers. I'm talking about AI software companies, TikTok headquarters, you name it. And so my focus is going to be keeping South Dakota the way it is. We're going to grow the economy. We are going to raise small business revenue. We're going to find new ways to generate revenue that doesn't involve asking the taxpayers for more money. And of course, as a CEO, I have a decades-long experience of not only finding unique ways to generate revenue, but also cut expenses, cut the fat, the pork, the waste, and I'll do that too. And so when the income goes up, the revenue goes up, and the overhead goes down, we will print massive budget surpluses in this state, and we will use that money to start fixing some of the serious problems.
What are some of the ways that you plan on incentivizing or encouraging or assisting small business owners to expand or to go into business in the first place?
Number one, we need to get immediate and significant property tax relief for all property owners. Everybody talks about single-family homeowners, and they're struggling, and they are. Seniors are being driven from their homes because of property taxes. Young people like my wife Liz and I 30 years ago are unable to experience the joy of buying their first home. And small business owners are getting crushed. If a small business owner rents or owns their property, their overhead has more than doubled in 5 years. And so there's a big misconception about business owners in South Dakota. People that have never ran a small business in a rural state like South Dakota, they think that business owners are just rolling in the cash and everything's great. Fact of the matter is, the overwhelming majority of small businesses in South Dakota, we estimate between 80 and 90%, don't actually take a profit check or what we call a dividend. They're just lucky if they can pay themselves a salary. So if their property tax goes from $7,000 a year to $15,000 a year, which somebody's did that I talked to yesterday, that $8,000 increase in property taxes comes right out of their paycheck. There is no dividend. There is no profit. They're just taking a paycheck. So small business owners are getting crushed by property taxes. And so the best way to stimulate our economy is to get massive and significant property tax relief. And the segment of the population nobody ever talks about, close to 40% of South Dakotans choose to rent rather than own, and they've seen their rents increase at a more rapid pace than any time in the history of this state, and that is largely due to property taxes. So property taxes need to be reduced statewide as soon as humanly possible. That will have a sudden positive impact, not only on our small business owners, but our seniors and our young families.
Municipalities have been worried about that. Mayor Paul Ten Haken has been worried about that. But mostly we've heard from smaller municipalities that say, hey, we don't have a sales tax base like a city like Sioux Falls does. So if we cut the property taxes, we're not going to have room for essential government functions in Moody County, in McCook County, in some of the in Bison County, Perkins County, sorry. What's your response to some of the small municipalities that are feeling nervous about that plan?
Sure. This is kind of the narrative the career politicians push. When somebody like the Doden administration or the Doden team says that we want to make the South Dakota state government more fiscally responsible, that we want to shrink the size and scope of the state government to make it nimble and efficient and lean, right? They say that that's going to cut into essential services, but the opposite is true. Anybody that's ever ran a small business or a dozens of small businesses, which I have, you know that when you cut overhead and raise revenue and you start turning out surpluses of money, you at that time have more money and more resources and more energy and more time to fund things like essential services in South Dakota. And so I know the counties handle property tax.
Right, yeah.
And so, you know, as governor or even the state leadership, our hands are tied a little bit because we don't control each assessor. We don't control the county taxes. But I also think that a CEO, an executive leader as governor, could find a way to put a lot of positive leverage on all of these rural counties to do the right thing and lower property taxes, so long as they actually had a competent, fiscally sound administration, which mine will be, that can help these counties find ways to generate new revenue. I would love to do some profit sharing with the state once the state starts turning out hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in budget surpluses every year. I would like to be able to use some of that money to buy down property taxes, to build out our rural infrastructure, to help rebuild our rural schools, and all of the things the career politicians have been promising us for years but have never actually done them.
How long does it take to get to that kind of profit margin from where we're sitting at today?
Very, very.
You're elected
quickly.
And I talk to you 2 years from now. Are we going to be there 4 years from now, 7 years from now?
Very quickly. Within a year or two, we will be turning out massive budget surpluses. It's not as complicated as the career politicians want you to think it is. Listen, the political bureaucracy, they want the citizens, and this isn't just South Dakota, this is any state's, the federal government. They want you to think that only your tax dollars can fund the state government. And when somebody like me comes in and says, I can find new ways to generate revenue for South Dakota, it actually hands more power back to the people, and that scares these folks. Listen, North Dakota has elected 3 or 4 consecutive business leaders as their governor. Last time I checked, they've got a $4 or $5 billion surplus. Now, I understand they have oil, but they run that state very well, very efficient. It's far more efficient than the state of South Dakota. They have less regulatory issues. North Dakota is a fiscally well-run state for the most part because they haven't had a career politician running that state in 20 years, and I think that's what South Dakota needs.
Help me understand what you mean by additional areas of revenue.
Sure.
Beyond taxes.
Yeah, there's lots. Listen, South Dakota is the friendliest place for the richest people in the world to park their money. We have the most money sitting in blind trusts of any state in the country. You know who number two is? Nevada. Why does, you know, people like J.B. Pritzker, the very, very liberal governor of Illinois, why does his family park their billions of dollars in South Dakota trusts? Because we charge next to nothing for them to do that. If we just raised our fees to be tied for the lowest in the country, we would generate massive amounts of money. I'm talking tens of millions of dollars. That's one example. I'm a big proponent of consumption taxes. I think property taxes are unconstitutional. I think people ought to pay
targeted consumption taxes. You mean what?
Consumption taxes. Like if you buy more products, if you spend more money, if you drive on our highways more, if you consume more of our resources, I think you ought to pay a higher share of our tax base than grandma that lives on a 30-acre hobby farm that grows her own garden and raises her own chickens, right? And so 2/3 of the visitors to this great state, and they're amazing people, And I want to encourage everybody in the country to come visit South Dakota. But two-thirds of our taxable receipts are conducted by non-residents. And we have the lowest non-resident tax base fee of any state in the country. I think if people are going to come here and hunt our wildlife and fish and drive on our roads and do business here, and Amazon's going to deliver packages with thousands of delivery vehicles using all of our basic resources and infrastructure. Amazon driver calls the same 911 you and I do. I think these folks ought to pay their fair share and help pay to rebuild our infrastructure in this state. I don't think landowners and property owners and you and I should be footing the bill for all of these folks that consume our resources. There are so many ways to generate revenue in a state like South Dakota. This is a very, very naturally rich state. People want to come here. Literally overnight, I will find ways to generate revenue that Dusty Johnson couldn't even fathom. So that's my plan. We're also going to cut waste and fraud and abuse. Our state budget has gone from less than $4 billion 7 years ago to almost $8 billion today. That's a big problem.
Where do you see some of those cuts? I mean, it's all open, so you can look at it now. What are some of the things on day one with, you know, DOGE-like efforts you think you can start cutting in state government?
You can say the state financials are open, but they're not that open. You can see broad ranges, you can see departments, and you can see big expenditures, but you can't drill down and see where all the nooks and crannies are. So until my administration takes over and my Department of Government Efficiency digs into every nickel, I can't specifically answer that, but here's what I can tell you. From an outsider's perspective and somebody who's been a CEO for a long time, the numbers don't pass the smell test. Wages are flat. Small business revenue is flat. Our budget has gone from $4 to $8 billion in 7 years. During that time, the rural infrastructure hasn't improved. Our education system hasn't improved. The drug epidemic has gotten worse. Rural health care has gotten worse. And our property taxes have doubled. So where did the $4 billion go? That's what I'm going to find out. There's going to be a financial reset in this state. We're going to be the fastest growing economy in the country. I think rural leadership teams from other states, I think their governors and their teams are going to come here in 3 and 4 years and want to know how we did what we did. I'm very optimistic. I think South Dakota can be the strongest rural economy in the country. And quite frankly, that's my main purpose for running. The state is perpetually broke. And we've been electing D.C. bureaucrats to come back and be our governor for far too long, and it's clearly not working.
So a couple things here, and one is you say on your website you're going to be the fiercest advocate, fierce is your word, for President Donald Trump and getting his agenda. And then you mentioned, you know, Washington, D.C. connection. Obviously, the governor of North Dakota and the former governor of South Dakota have gone on to serve in the president's administration. Do you have your sights on that administration as well, that national voice?
0.0%. I'm a South Dakota first. I was born and raised here. I've lived here all 50 years. Every dollar I've invested, every job I've created has been in South Dakota, and I will never, ever change that. I have zero aspirations beyond helping the people in South Dakota. As soon as I do that and we get our state back on track fiscally, I'm going to go back and see my puppies and my grandkids and my beautiful children and their families. And maybe if they'll have me back, they'll even let me come back as the CEO of the investment group that I created. So I walked away from all of that, and I'm risking literally everything I have to fight for the future of South Dakota. And so I couldn't be more happy to specifically answer your question, because I don't want you to think I'm dodging it, because I'm not. Donald Trump has brought back a culture of winning for conservatives in this country. You don't have to agree with every single thing he says or does, but you at least have to acknowledge he knows how to build consensus. He knows how to build successful teams. He has provided a pathway for people like me to have the confidence and the courage to step forward and say, I want to lead. I want to make South Dakota First a very, very successful slogan, not just a slogan. I want it to actually happen. And so I will promise you this, and I'll promise you this to all of your listeners, and I I close out my bus tour events, by the way, a little plug there. We're on a 66-county, 100-plus stop bus tour. Nobody's ever done that in the history of this state. I was the first Republican gubernatorial candidate in decades to go to the heart of Pine Ridge, Rosebud, Mission. I'm going to every single tribe. I'm going to every single county. I'm going to shake every person's hand in this state. But Donald Trump has brought back a vision of winning. And my litmus test as your governor is this. If it doesn't help the majority of South Dakotans move forward in a positive direction, then we don't do it. Every decision I make as your governor has to pass that test. Is it good for South Dakota? Yes or no? Is it good for the majority of citizens in South Dakota? I will make decisions based on the will of the people that live here. Nothing more, nothing less.
You mentioned the majority. You also would be governor for the minority, people who are maybe having hard times and in need of assistance programs, even if it's only temporarily. We're coming up on the 35th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is the largest minority in the nation and possibly South Dakota. And certainly, you know, social programs you've talked about, those often address people who might be in the minority and might disagree with some of your personal feelings. How do you account for compassion, listening, and dealing with the rights of American citizens who might also be in the minority?
Yeah, it's very important, and it's a great question. I don't get asked this very often, so I appreciate you asking it. I'm running to be governor for all 940,000 people. I'm not a petty person. I never have been. Just because you don't agree with me on all the issues doesn't mean that I don't want to help you or that I don't care for you. My father became disabled when I was very young. My siblings and I were raised on Social Security. A lot of people don't know that. My mom worked three jobs to provide the basic necessity. And if it wasn't for Social Security, I wouldn't be sitting here with you today because I don't know what would have happened to our family. We probably would have been split up. I would have probably lived with my grandparents. I don't know. So I understand the plight of people that are down on their luck. My dad was permanently disabled. He was down on his luck for 40 years, and he needed that assistance. And I'm all for those programs. But I also think it's okay that we look at those programs and make sure that they're being as efficient as they possibly can, to make sure that we don't have a small percentage of the individuals using it that are abusing the system. I think able-bodied people should work for themselves and should provide for themselves. But I couldn't agree with you more. There are a lot of people that have acute issues that pop up or have things that they can't control, and those people need assistance. And I will be very proactive in making sure that every single one of those people have everything they need. People forget. That was me growing up. My dad was a registered Democrat till the day he passed away. I understand both sides of the aisle way more than people would probably understand. I am a very conservative person. I'm very, very, very pro-life. I believe in small, fiscally sound government. But you don't have to agree with me on those issues for me to want to make sure you have the basic necessities you need to be comfortable and that your family has the basic necessities. Those things aren't mutually exclusive. They should have nothing to do with one another. And so that's another big conception out there. People that have known me for 30 years know how much I've done through my companies. You know, my wife and I have been very generous. We've been very, very fortunate to get to a position where we have more money and resources than we need ever. And so we've been very proactive in helping people. We don't announce a lot of it. I don't give massive amounts of money to big national charities because we do everything ourselves, face-to-face, hand-to-hand. I can't tell you how many thousands of people we've helped out here in South Dakota that have been down on their luck that will never, ever make the press or the papers. But the people that know me know that. And I think as more people get to know me, they're going to start seeing that side of me more, that, hey, Toby actually cares about the little people far more than his opponent in this race ever will. I mean, my opponents never had a W-2 that wasn't signed by a taxpayer. I think being a public servant should not be a lifetime institution. It should be just that, serving the public, nothing more, nothing less. And clearly, as a CEO, uncomfortable as it is to say, a wealthy person, somebody that had a beautiful life in my 40s, I'm here because I want to serve the people of South Dakota. And I don't think my opponent in this race can look you and the people in this state in the eye and say the same thing with any any type of genuine look or feel at all. And so I think that's what's going to separate him and I in this race.
That's gubernatorial candidate Toby Doden. You can see all our interviews with upcoming gubernatorial candidates on our YouTube page. Look for SDPB. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.